It is Monday, September the 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, explosions in two U.S. states and stabbings in another.
I think it's clear that the bombings are related, that the individuals who pulled those off were aware of the other. I think the stabbing may have been opportunistic.
Key elections in Russia and Germany. It's federal budget standoff time here in Washington. Plus, the Rolling Stones in a new documentary premiering in Toronto. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. New York City's Mayor Bill de Blasio, speaking not long after the blast, said people have to be patient right now to get the full story behind Saturday night's bombing that happened in Manhattan in the Chelsea neighborhood that injured 29 people in one of the city's busiest areas. He also spoke about the possibility of this being an act of terrorism.
There is no specific and credible threat against New York City at this point in time from any terror organization. So as we are analyzing what happened here, we are doing against the backdrop where we have no credible and specific threat at this moment. But we do want to be very clear. The initial indications is this was an intentional act.
Several hours after de Blasio spoke, the New York governor, Andrew Cuomo, said the blast was an act of terrorism, but said there is no evidence of international terrorism.
The bottom line on this is, number one, whoever placed these bombs, we will find and they will be brought to justice. Period. You have the finest police agencies in the world when you come to New York. And we will find who planted these explosives and they will be punished. Number two, we will not allow these type of people and these type of threats to disrupt our life in New York. That's what they want to do. We're not going to let them do it. This is freedom. This is democracy. And we're not going to allow them to take that from us.
The New York City blast and the locating not far away of an unexploded pressure cooker bomb came hours after a pipe bomb exploded in a trash bin in a New Jersey beach town 135 kilometers away, forcing the cancellation of a charity foot race involving thousands of runners. No one was hurt. Also Saturday, 9 people were stabbed by a lone assailant at a mall in the U.S. state of Minnesota. None of the victims there suffered life-threatening injuries. The attacker has been identified as 22-year-old Somali-American. The leader of a Somali community there said and told VOA the suspect, who was shot and killed by police during the attack, was a person named Dahir Adan. He was also known in the community, he said, and was working as a part-time security officer and thought of as, in his words, a smart and reliable person. For some perspective on the bomb blast and the stabbings, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Thomas Sanderson, who directs the Transnational Threats Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
I think it's clear that the bombings are related, that the individuals who pulled those off were aware of the other plans. I think the stabbing may have been opportunistic on the part of someone who heard the call to battle quite some time ago, and in light of what happened with the bombings, decided to pile on. There's always the possibility that the individual who conducted the stabbings in Minnesota was part of the same network, but I think that's less likely at this point. But I think the bombers are very likely to have done this in coordination with one another. I don't think there was any significant holiday taking place at this time that would otherwise negate that hypothesis, but we're still in the early hours after the investigation started, and we will probably learn a lot more. The forensics on the bomb will give us a decent amount of information, but these are not unique tools and unique technology, so they're not going to have very significant errors in the technological realm, but someone's DNA is going to be on some component of that pressure cooker bomb.
What likelihood do you think, from your position, is a jihadist organization behind these attacks?
Better than 50% at this point. But in a target as diverse as New York, there could be other individuals that they were targeting and other groups that could have carried this out. A white supremacist group, for example, an anarchist group. You know, lots of options here. Targeting the Marine Corps 5-miler, I think it was, down in New Jersey, that would suggest more likely a jihadist connection because it's the U.S. military.
The blast in New York came just a few days before the opening of the U.N. General Assembly. Can we expect more such attacks in the U.S.?
In the U.S. or in New York because of the UNGA?
In the U.S. broadly.
Well, given that these two happen, yes. I think that when individuals are inspired or have been motivated to see eye to eye with a group like ISIS or Al-Qaeda, and they see other examples of how things are done, then they often expedite plans. They may have, there may be hundreds of ready-made bombs across the country right now. And when people see others set them off, there's a copycat effect. And others who want that impact, who want that thrill of being one of the soldiers for ISIS and wanting to make an impact. So I would not be surprised if we saw more of these types of attacks.
What is the defense against them?
Almost nothing, especially if these are individuals who are inspired individuals, who are lone wolves, who have no previous connection through social media or actual contact on the battlefield with ISIS or Al-Qaeda. If it's just an individual who has been inspired by what ISIS has done, by what Al-Qaeda has done, and has decided to take it upon themselves to build a device and strike, it is impossible to find that person and prevent them unless they make a very significant mistake, such as talking about what they plan to do on social media, or if someone happens to see suspicious activity. That's going to be very hard to do, and that's why it's quite easy for these individuals to pull off an attack like this.
Thomas Anderson directs the Transnational Threats Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Early election results are showing that Russia's ruling party has won Sunday's parliamentary election. Last time Russia held parliamentary elections in 2011, opposition parties were banned from participating. And amid evidence of widespread vote rigging, tens of thousands took to the streets in protest, the biggest public challenge so far to Vladimir Putin, who has faced this in 17 years in power. Political analyst Nikolai Petrov tells VOA the Kremlin has learned its lesson.
The Kremlin is not eager to practice large-scale fraud. It's eager to avoid any scandals, to avoid any threat of mass protests.
With about 22% of the ballots counted, President Putin's United Russian Party has more than 50% of the vote, the Liberal Democratic Party trailing with 15% of the vote, the Communists 14%, and a Just Russia Party with 6%. Analysts have seen this voting as a likely referendum on Putin's expected 2018 run for re-election. Exit polls are showing German Chancellor Angela Merkel's political party endured the second setback in a state election in 2 weeks on Sunday, as many voters turned to the left and right in Berlin. Projections show that Social Democrats and Merkel's Christian Democratic Party emerged from the Berlin state election as the strongest two parties, but both lost enough support that they won't be able to continue a coalition government. The vote follows a European Union meeting in Bratislava, Slovakia, where, among other issues, migration was high on the agenda. Some EU leaders have expressed their disappointment with Merkel's policy on accepting migrants and refugees from the Middle East, Afghanistan, and North Africa. We asked Monash University Europe analyst Ben Wellings if Merkel might be out of touch.
I don't know that she's out of touch with reality, but she might be out of touch with public opinion in Germany and some of the other leaders amongst the European Union heads of state and government. So the difficulty for her is to how can she reassert her authority and Germany's authority within the EU when she's got this weakening support base back in Germany. And so that means that the result in Berlin has ripple effects right throughout EU politics at this very delicate moment.
Merkel continues to believe the current situation in the EU is critical, she says, largely because of the changing sentiment towards people in need. Once again, Ben Wellings.
She is committed to this this policy. She wants what she sees as a humanitarian response. But this has elicited a reaction not just within or amongst the German electorate, but within the EU as well, particularly from countries called the Visegrad Four, that is to say Poland, Hungary, Slovakia and the Czech Republic. And we're seeing a lot of resistance there to not just the kind of the symbolism and reality of Merkel's policy, but also the European Commission's plans at so-called burden sharing of spreading the million or more migrants who arrived last year around the European Union. And this is what's causing difficulties both domestically and in the councils of the European Union.
And now back to that Sunday election in Germany, where Merkel's party won just 17.5% of the vote, which was down 5.8%. We ask Wellings what the German people are trying to tell their leaders.
They're probably saying that for a variety of reasons that they are not happy with the levels of migration into Europe from Syria and other conflict countries in states of conflict. So, but it is also, you know, if we keep the Brexit vote in mind and explanations for Brexit there and assume that something similar is going on, there is a kind of a serious resentment that's building up against leaders within the European Union. Now, of course, we see this in other parts of the world. You know, Donald Trump's support is often explained in these terms as well. But, you know, it seems that there are people who are not happy with the current setup. They feel insecure, and that can be through migration, it can be through economics, it can be through a whole range of issues, and they are punishing the people who they see as responsible for this.
Ben Wellings is an expert on the politics of nationalism, Euroscepticism, and Brexit in contemporary Europe. He is also a professor at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, what has become an annual drama is underway right now here in Washington. Lawmakers have 2 weeks to agree to a spending budget for the next year. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman speaks with my colleague Jim Stevenson about it all.
The fiscal year ends September 30th. At the stroke of midnight. And on October 1st, if Congress has not acted, has not appropriated funds, and the president has not signed off on that, then the government is left without any money to spend. And it can maintain emergency operations, but non-essential government, federal government activities grind to a halt. And there is always this drama because we have a very politically polarized Congress. What gets funded, and can they cobble together something that can get through both houses of Congress and earn the president's signature?
It's also an election year, which adds a little bit of drama to this.
It's somewhat unusual. Typically, Congress avoids big fiscal fights during an election year. There's sort of this understanding that neither party wants to be tarred with a government shutdown when their members are running for re-election. And so this is somewhat unusual in that the big fights are usually reserved for sort of off years politically. However, there was an agreement that was signed 2 years ago that laid out sort of the fiscal roadmap for a 2-year period to include this very election year. And after a while, it was decided by Republicans that they weren't very happy with the restrictions on military spending. And Democrats said, well, come to think of it, we're not all that thrilled with the restrictions on domestic spending. So there was this idea that maybe they would break the budget caps in some way. And the fight right now is, well, Republicans would very much like to boost up the military portion, and Democrats say, well, absolutely, but if we're going to do that, let's have more for roads and bridges and education and health initiatives and what have you. Republicans say not so fast. So that's sort of the rub, and this comes at a time when Uncle Sam has literally zero appropriated funds specifically designated to fight the Zika virus. There are some real challenges to be tackled here.
Something on the order of a government shutdown would not sit well right before the election. It would be fresh in voters' minds.
The conventional wisdom is, and some Republicans would disagree with this, but that the conventional wisdom has been that in recent memory, it's been the Republicans who have spoiled for shutdowns. However, they have chosen these shutdowns normally on years when there isn't an election. As a result, something very interesting has happened. The following year, by and large, Republicans have not been punished for a shutdown that occurred the previous year. Americans have very short memories when it comes to these sorts of things, and by the time November of the following year rolls around, it's largely forgotten. No one knows how this would play out if it occurred in the beginning of October, literally 5 weeks before Americans chose the next president and chose which party controls Congress. But the old days where things were, where there was a year-long appropriations process and the American people could weigh in, they could see the bill being formulated and they could weigh in, I'm afraid that that's a bit of yesteryear, and I don't know if or when that will ever come back.
Yesteryear, huh? VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. And it's time now to see what's trending online. Of course, there was that explosion in New York City over the weekend. That likely got a lot of buzz. Our social media expert, G. Abby Lee, is here. What you got, G?
Hi, Steve. People are using hashtag Manhattan Explosion to talk about the incident online. And the main debate on social media is surrounding what New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio said about the explosion. He called it an intentional act, but stopped short of calling it an act of terrorism.
So I see. So what is the controversy?
So some people seem to believe that de Blasio's wording was not strong enough. For example, one user tweeted a meme of a confused person staring at computer coding and wrote this: "Me trying to calculate how an explosion can be intentional, yet not terror-related." There's also a lot of buzz surrounding presidential candidates' responses. So ABC News reporter Liz Cruz filmed Hillary Clinton's response to the explosion on her campaign plane and posted it on Twitter. When a reporter asked for a response to Donald Trump calling it a bomb, she answered, "It's important to know the facts before speaking."
Like many people, I saw the video and the replies to all of it. It seems like Trump supporters are arguing that he was right, whereas Clinton supporters are saying that accuracy and fact-checking are important.
That's exactly it. Our own Steve Herman also did a live story on the incident, and you can check it out on VOA News Facebook page.
And that's different from our VOA Now page, which is at facebook.com/VOA Now, all one word. Tell me, G, what else is trending?
Hashtag social good and hashtag 2030 now are both trending online because a UN-sponsored summit called Social Good Summit is now taking place in New York City. The goal of the 2-day conference is to examine the impact of technology and new media on social good initiatives around the world. The number 2030 comes from the question posed by the United Nations Foundation. What type of world do I want to live in by the year 2030? Now, the UN Foundation organizes the event, and the foundation is working with online publication Mashable, and you can check out the live stream at mashable.com/SGS. That's all for me today. Steve?
And I will check it out. Many thanks to you, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, the one you're listening to, International Edition, is on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
As the saying goes, all good things must come to an end. And the same will go for the Cassini mission to Saturn as it begins its final year of operation. NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory says it has big plans for the orbiter as it makes its year-long last mission. The space agency says during its final year, Cassini will make the closest ever observations of the ring planet, take some ultra-close images of its atmosphere, directly analyze dust-sized particles in Saturn's main rings, and sample the outer limits of its atmosphere. These observations will provide scientists with information about Saturn, such as its interior structure, the exact length of its day, and the total mass of the rings, something that could help determine their age. The orbiter's mission will come to a dramatic conclusion on September 15, 2017, when it will be sent diving through Saturn's atmosphere toward the planet itself. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us today. You know what? It's time now for a little something from our music department.
Hola, Habana! Buenas noches, mi gente de Cuba!
Yes, that is the famous Rolling Stones in Cuba just a few months ago. And Friday night, band member Keith Richards returned to the Toronto International Film Festival for a second straight year, joining bandmate Ronnie Wood at the premiere of a documentary of their recent Latin American tour that culminated in a historic Cuban concert.
We are so heard today at the reception. You gon' be her connection. At her feet was a footloose man. Now you can't always get what you want. Now you can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want.
Just one of the many songs the Stones played in Havana. That documentary film, which premiered at the Toronto Film Festival, is called The Rolling Stones' Olé, 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 A Trip Across Latin America. It goes behind the scenes with the veteran rock band as they play across the region for the first time in 10 years, chronicling their interaction with fans in a range of countries where their music was once banned or stifled. Richard spoke on the red carpet ahead of the screening of the documentary.
It's strange maybe that some of the affection is because we were suppressed, you know, for some time in various countries. And I guess that's what happens when you try and suppress something. Certain things become obvious and stronger.
Directed by Paul Dugdale and shot through February and March, the film combines footage from concerts in Peru, Colombia, Brazil, and elsewhere, and interviews with the band members, their fans, and tour managers as they plan that Free Cuba event. The Stones' Ronnie Wood on what it was like performing in Cuba.
Yeah, it was quite a history-making time, you know.
Is Cuba the highlight of your career in a way?
Well, in a way for the opening up of the people, you know, for the what it meant to them. Yeah, it was a good gig to us, you know, but it meant so much to them.
At one point, the band was forced to reschedule the concert in Havana after U.S. President Barack Obama announced his own three-day visit to Cuba after decades of hostility between the former Cold War foes. Stones formed in London in 1962, just 3 years after Fidel Castro's rebels toppled a pro-American government in Havana, and he became the country's new leader. Satisfaction is a big hit at all the Rolling Stones concerts, including the one in Havana, as it has been for decades. Yes, indeedy. They've been trying to get Satisfaction for about 50 years now. You think they'll ever get it? Well, let's certainly hope so now that they're all in their 90s. Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. They're really not that old. Good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington, getting a lot of satisfaction out of it. Wishing you a great Monday, everyone.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The problems facing the world today are notoriously resistant to unilateral solutions, said U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken in a recent address in New York. Mr. Blinken spoke days before the opening of the 71st meeting of the U.N. General Assembly. He said the national interest of the United States demands the global engagement that has been the hallmark of President Barack Obama's administration, engagement built on the foundation of a system of rules, principles, and international institutions, which the United States, as the world's rising global power after the Second World War, helped establish. It is a system not without problems, but which got the big picture right, said Deputy Secretary Blinken, averting new global cataclysms, ending the Cold War peacefully, creating the space and stability for countries to prosper. Under President Obama's engagement policy, Mr. Blinken noted, the United States, among other instances, worked at the UN Security Council to advance nuclear negotiations with Iran and to destroy Syria's declared strategic chemical weapons capacity. Mr. Blinken offered examples of collaboration in human rights with our re-engagement on the Human Rights Council, where we have shed light on some of the world's worst human rights conditions and violators, and work the U.S. has done with new leadership at the Organization of American States to strengthen that institution's role in defending democracy and promoting human rights. Mr. Blinken stated we have reinvigorated our transatlantic partnerships and strengthened relationships with Asia's key institutions and collaborative efforts in establishing a coalition of more than 67 countries to confront Daesh and undermine its vicious, phony caliphate. Working with others, Deputy Secretary Blinken said, we build a foundation of trust, greater alignment of interest, habits of cooperation, and greater legitimacy that better enables us to mobilize others against common threats and seize common opportunities. The bulk of U.S. global engagement happens at the United Nations, which, despite its flaws and its need for reform, Mr. Blinken called the gold standard of global action when mobilized effectively. Now was the time to strengthen the U.N., to adapt it to new realities, he said. The U.N. is worth fighting for, said Deputy Secretary Blinken. It ensures that our collective action better upholds our own promises, and it will help us shape and adopt an international system that actually lives up to the vision of those who first built it, a global project that remains now, as it did then, indispensable to the health, the strength, the security, the prosperity of every nation, especially the United States.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. It's 4.